A University of Tennessee economist is joining Fortune 100 CEOs on a White House advisory board. Marianne Wanamaker, an associate professor of economics in the Haslam College of Business here on the campus of the University of Tennessee, has been named to the American Workforce Policy Advisory Board. Marianne, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And congratulations for being named to that advisory board. What is it exactly? What does one advise when they get there?
So the administration has been putting a focus on the skills gap, the so-called skills gap, which most people have heard of. But basically the idea that employers have open jobs and we have available workers, and yet those two things don't seem to match. And the unemployment rate in the U.S. is really low, but the labor force participation rate, which is the thing that tells you how many kind of able-bodied people are off the sidelines and in the workforce or looking for a job, that number is suppressed still. It's suppressed relative to what it was in 2007, and it's really low relative to what it was in 2001. And that's a big deal. That's a lot of people. And so the administration has been trying to move that number. And it is creeping up, but there's still a long way to go. And so this board is going to advise a national council. So the national council is kind of the intra-governmental body that's thinking about this. So it includes the Commerce Secretary, the Labor Secretary, Secretary of Education, Treasury Secretary, and they're working on workforce development, training, apprenticeships, multiple pathways to career success, really trying to put forward everything the government has to encourage people to get in the labor force. And this outside advisory board advises that council. So that's why it's, you know, has all of these kind of Fortune 100 CEOs on it. It has a lot of people who represent community colleges who are kind of critical to the education piece. It includes manufacturers. It includes small business, people representing small business, all sorts of different parts of the U.S. Constituency.
You're up there rubbing shoulders with the CEOs of Walmart, Home Depot, Visa, Apple. By the way, can you get me a discount on an iPhone?
I'm just shooting for a selfie. That's really my students. My undergrads are like, "Can you get a selfie with Tim Cook?" So that's my job. You know, it's funny. I worked at the White House for a year, and I thought I understood all the ins and outs of that complex. And then they sent us the instructions for how to get to the first meeting, and it was clear that I was not aware of the VIP entrance. So this is going to be, I think it's going to be entertaining, you know, from that perspective.
That's like me in airports. Like, it took me years to realize there was a special comfortable place.
Yeah, like, exactly. Exactly.
I didn't even see it.
Exactly. Yeah.
What path led you to the White House?
Well, I mean, really, I was minding my own business, doing my day job, and I am an economic historian and a labor economist, and I went to grad school with a bunch of really talented labor economists, and one of them had this position in the White House, working for the Council of Economic Advisors, covering labor markets, education policy under the Obama administration. And when he was ready to leave, it's a one-year commitment, and when he was ready to leave, he called and said, "Do you want my job?" And this was spring of 2017. And I balked and said, "No, I definitely don't. Thank you for asking, but I definitely do not want to relocate my family to Washington, D.C. I don't want to work. It's too hard. I don't want to do this." And he slowly talked me into it, along with the dean, Dean Mangum, and some others in the Haslam College, kind of made me see that it was potentially really difficult in the short run, but would pay off in the long run, both for me and for the university. I think that's been true, actually. I think it's paid off a lot quicker than we had anticipated. But in any case, I eventually got to yes, and so relocated my husband and two young kids to Washington, D.C. for a year, which was incredibly disruptive, but also just a really amazing experience.
Well, I imagine it'd be really disruptive because you know it's only going to last a year. So by the time you sort of master getting around and all, you know, the best place to eat and where you get this, and
right,
it's over.
Yeah, I mean, there was a whole lot of transition. We made some really good decisions on the front end. We sold our house in Knoxville, so we didn't have to worry about it, which I know seems crazy, but it was just going to be too much to have to worry about either an empty house or a rented house. We just knew we couldn't do it. So we did that, and We took a student from UT who had worked for us as a babysitter for many years. She moved with us, and that kind of facilitated everything. So that was those two things really kind of made it work.
And so once you got there, it sounds like you had an amazing experience. What was the most amazing aspect of the whole experience?
There's so many parts, but I think the thing that I really learned there and that I really experienced was just how hard government work is, especially at that level. I mean, I had, before I was an academic, I was a business consultant, and I really felt like that was kind of my peak capacity. I couldn't possibly work harder than I worked as a business consultant. And we work hard as academics, but it's different. You know, the pace is just not... it's just not like what it is in the private sector. And then I got to then I got to the White House, and it was unreal. I mean, really, for the first month, I couldn't remember if I'd eaten lunch every day. I couldn't remember, you know, just the basic things that you do to maintain yourself, I had totally forgotten to do. It was really remarkable how hard we worked. And it wasn't just the political class. It wasn't just the people who came in, you know, to serve in the Trump administration. It was the career people, too, who've been there 20, 30 years. They work really hard, and they're really good at what they do. And I certainly didn't appreciate that before I got up there.
And you talked about earlier about there's this gap between available jobs and people filling them and going to the right places. How far along are you and other people in figuring this out? What are some of the real causes of that? People not willing to move? I mean, what's...
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how much you can learn from just some kind of pretty simple data, right? So the pretty simple data will tell you that people move a lot less than they used to. And so, the quintessential unemployed person in the U.S. who's lost their job for whatever reason, be it trade or automation or just, you know, idiosyncratic shocks, that person is something like 10 times more likely to change industries as they are to change their county of residence. So people really are rooted where they are. And that reasons for that, I mean, you know, I don't know that we totally understand that. Some of it is related to the cost of living. So it's really difficult to move to a bigger place with more job opportunities if you can't pay the first month's rent. And, you know, we tend to sort of joke about how expensive it is to live in San Francisco, looking at it from a Knoxvillean's perspective. And that's funny, maybe, but it's not funny if you're living in rural Tennessee and you want to move to Knoxville, or more importantly, perhaps Nashville, and you think about the rent there. That's not funny. That's not a funny difference, and it really holds people back. There are also other restrictions. You know, there are occupational licensing issues that tend to keep people in place. They can't move across state lines without going back through the licensing process, which is really costly. And then I think there are just cultural things. I think we've just kind of gotten ourselves into a place where people are less willing to pick up and move for economic opportunity. So that's part of it. The other part of it is we have faced, you know, a pretty substantial reduction in the demand for lower skilled workers in the U.S., workers with fewer years of education. And again, some of that is about trade. Some of it is about automation. And that drag on labor demand hurts. And then the final thing I think really matters in this conversation is the opioid crisis. It's a lot of people who can't pass a drug test. And if you can't pass a drug test, you don't have a hope for getting into, you know, into these open jobs. So it's it's a bunch of things simultaneously. There's a skill piece to it in that we think over time the U.S. will require the jobs in the U.S. will require more and more skill, and therefore we have to ramp up the skill capacity of our workers. And Tennessee has been really a leader in thinking about this, the Drive to 55 and Free Community College, which of course started as, you know, for young people fresh out of school, and now the state has extended to anybody, right? You can go back to school no matter how old you are, and I think that's really critical moving forward.
I was out in California recently talking to teachers and some of these expensive counties and saying that they were going to have to move because they couldn't afford to live in the counties they were teaching. You mentioned San Francisco. I met people there that were renting tiny apartments with five other people just so they could go work three jobs. I mean, it sounds like this is, we're talking about a much bigger thing here. What do we do? What can we do?
Well, I, on a very personal note on this, I live in a neighborhood in Knoxville that is notorious for fighting development. And I've always been quite proud of my neighborhood for that, that we've really, you know, put the kibosh on a whole bunch of big condo developments and whatever right at our doorstep. And then I got to Washington and realized that housing prices are kind of a crisis, and that one of the key causes of high housing prices are zoning restrictions like the ones that my neighborhood supports every time they come up. And Knoxville's undergoing this Recode Knoxville issue right now, which is exactly this question of, okay, if we're going to grow, we're going to build, you know, the economy in Knoxville, there are going to be more jobs, we need more workers, and we're going to keep our same zoning restrictions, we're just going to have urban sprawl, right? We're just going to keep spreading, the traffic's just going to get worse, and the prices for housing downtown are just going to get bigger. And we need to rethink this, and San Francisco needs to do the same thing, right? They need to rethink how they've zoned things, how dense they're willing to let housing go. So it's not just San Francisco, it's us too, and it's Nashville too. I mean, you know, the housing prices in Nashville, is anyone who lives there will tell you, have really skyrocketed the last 20 years or so. And part of it is zoning. It's our preferences not to have high density residential buildings in our kind of quaint, pretty neighborhoods.
Being an economic historian, are you optimistic about these things?
On the skills gap, I'm optimistic. Yeah. I mean, I think if you sit back and think about it for a second, and I'm telling you a story that says, you know, employers have open jobs, but they can't find the workers, and as a result, they're sacrificing profitability, okay, then one of the first responses you might have is, well, surely the employer should change their behavior. Surely there's something they can do to solve this problem. So traditionally, the U.S. has not been a leader in terms of kind of on-the-job training. So it has not been our protocol to say, I have an open job, I'm going to go find a worker. They may not be trained for this job yet, but I will bring them on. I'll give them the training they need. You know, they'll spend 2 or 3 years in some sort of on-the-job apprenticeship, and then they'll work for the company for a while. We've not been a leader in that, and so I think part of solving the skills gap problem is going to be private sectors, I mean, the employers sort of rethinking their strategies. And I wanted to say, because I think it's so important, we have this misperception in this country that millennials are this different type of worker, okay? And if you hire a millennial, they're going to be in your office for 6 months and then they're going to, you know, not show up one day. And the data do not support that interpretation. They are no different than their predecessors. And so, you know, America's employers shouldn't be scared to give them on-the-job training and assume that they may stick around just as long as their parents would have, you know, and let the employer kind of reap the benefit of that training.
Yeah, I've never seen, in my work life, I haven't seen any evidence of this disappearing act and laziness. I mean, they work harder than I worked at that age, I can tell you just from personal experience. They're really sharp.
Yeah, our stories about millennials are really unfortunate. A good friend of mine is a millennial and has a blog, and the title of her blog is "Got a Problem? Blame a Millennial." And I really agree with her. I mean, I really think we placed a lot at their feet that they do not deserve.
Are your students really interested in what you're doing, and what do you tell them? How do you bring back this real world experience in DC to the classroom in Knoxville?
I think they're getting a window into what it means to be an economist and what it means to be in public policy and the questions we have to think about and the sort of extracurricular issues that come up while we're there, the issues we had to deal with. I think it's been really good for them. So, you know, as for the board going forward, I don't know yet, but I can't imagine it'll be bad for them.
And so when you go up to D.C., you don't live there anymore. You just go up. Did they put you up in a nice hotel?
You know, they emailed me to ask me about my travel preferences, which is kind of a hilarious thing to ask an academic. So I said, I prefer to ride on a plane. And there's a Hampton Inn a few blocks from the White House that I've stayed in before. It's really clean and nice. They have free breakfast. You know, I'd like to stay there. And so they wrote back and said, the Hampton Inn is too expensive, but we can put you up at the Willard, which is an intercontinental hotel right literally next door to the White House, and maybe one of the, you know, the most famous kind of meet and greet see and be seen places in Washington, perhaps next to the Trump Hotel at the moment. It's the number one. And so apparently they have some sort of killer government rage. So I'm staying at the Willard. It'll be entertaining.
Well, anything you can do to keep costs down.
Yeah, exactly. I'm happy to sacrifice.
Do you find some of your students, because of what you're able to tell them about this, are starting to maybe rethink what they might want to do with their career path? Because in a way, you're modeling like this is another thing you can do with this kind of background.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, you know, when I was at the council last year, there was an undergrad from UT who had gotten a job there as an intern, and then he was so good they hired him on full-time staff. As far as I know, he's the first UT student to do that, maybe ever. And I think between him and me, I'm hoping that we are trailblazers in a sense, that there will be, you know, other students who choose to do the same thing. And I hope the students in my class right now see the opportunities of being an econ major, being in public policy and public service. Again, it's really hard work, but really rewarding.
Marianne Wanamaker, thanks so much for talking with us on Changing Course.
Thanks for having me.